Despite all my wild ways, one thing I did manage to do in a strangely disciplined fashion was my practice of yoga. It started one summer vacation when I was 12. A whole bunch of us cousins met every year in my grandfather's ancestral home. In the backyard, there was an old well, over 150 feet deep. While the girls played hide-and-seek, the regular game played by us boys was to jump into the well and then climb up again. Both jumping down and climbing up were a challenge. If you didn't do it properly, your brains could become a smear on the wall. While you were climbing up, there were no steps. You simply had to clutch at the rock surface and claw yourself up. Your fingernails often bled out of sheer pressure. Just a few of the boys could do this. I was one of them, and I was pretty good at it. One day, a man over 70 years of age appeared. He watched us for a while. Without a word, he jumped into the well. We thought he was finished, but he climbed out quicker than me. I cast aside my pride and asked him just one question, how? "Come, learn yoga," said the old man. I followed him like a puppy, and that was how I became a student of Malladihalli Swami, as this old man was known, and got into yoga. In the past, waking me up every morning was a family project. My family would try to make me sit up in bed. I would keel over and fall asleep again. My mother would hand me my toothbrush. I would stick it in my mouth and fall asleep. In desperation, she would push me into the bathroom. I would promptly fall asleep again. But 3 months after starting yoga, my body started coming awake at 3:40 every morning, without any external prompting, as it does even today. After I woke, my practices would simply happen no matter where I was and in what situation, without a single day's break. This simple yoga, called Angamardana, a system of yoga that strengthens sinews and limbs, definitely set me apart in any group of people physically and mentally. But that's about all, or so I believed. In time, I lost all faith in structured education. It wasn't cynicism. I had enough zest and life in me to keep me involved in everything, but my dominant quality even at this age was clarity. I was not actively looking for inconsistencies or loopholes in anything I was taught. I just saw them. I have never looked for anything in my life. I just look. That is what I am trying to teach people now. If you really want to know spirituality, don't look for anything. People think spirituality is about looking for God or truth or the ultimate. The problem is, you have already defined what you're looking for. It is not the object of your search that is important. It is the faculty of looking. The ability to simply look without motive is missing in the world today. Everybody is a psychological creature wanting to assign meaning to everything. Seeking is not about looking for something. It is about enhancing your perception, your very faculty of seeing. After high school, I embarked on a self-study program at the Mysore University Library. I was the first person there in the morning at 9 and the last to be shooed out at 8:30 at night. Between breakfast and dinner, my only sustenance was books. Although I was always ravenous, I skipped lunch for a whole year. I read widely, from Homer to Popular Mechanics, Kafka to Kalidasa, Dante to Dennis the Menace. I emerged from that 1 year more knowledgeable, but with more questions than ever before. My mother's tears compelled me to enroll grudgingly in Mysore University as a student of English literature. But I continued to carry the cloud of a billion questions like a dark halo around me all the time. Neither the library nor my professors could dispel it. Once again, I spent most of my time outside the classroom rather than in it. I found that all that was happening in class was the dictation of notes, and I was definitely not planning to be a stenographer. I once asked a lecturer to give me her notes so I could photocopy them. It would save her the trouble of dictation and me the trouble of attending. Finally, I made a deal with all the teachers, who were more than happy not to have me in class. On each day of the month, they would mark me present in class. On the last day of the month, the attendance was registered. That day, I would enter just to make sure they were keeping up their end of the bargain. A group of us started meeting under a huge banyan tree on the campus grounds. Someone named it the Banyan Tree Club, and the label stuck. The club had a motto, "We do it for the fun of it." We would assemble under the tree on our motorcycles and talk for hours on a variety of subjects, from how to make Java motorcycles go faster than they did to how to make the world a better place. Of course, we would never get off our motorcycles at any point. That would have been sacrilege. By the time I was done with university, I had ridden all over the country. Initially, I traveled South India on my bicycle. Later, I crisscrossed the entire country on my motorcycle. Then it was natural to cross the national borders. But when I reached the India-Nepal frontier, I was told that my motorcycle registration and driving license weren't enough. I needed more papers. After that, it became my dream to somehow earn enough money to travel the world on my motorcycle. It wasn't just wanderlust. The truth is, I was restless. I wanted to know something. I did not know what, and I did not know where I needed to go to get it. But in my innermost being, I knew I wanted more. I never considered myself particularly impulsive. I was just life-oriented. I measured the consequences of my actions. It is just that the more dangerous they were, the more they attracted me. Someone once told me, "My guardian angel must be very good and perpetually working overtime." There was always in me a longing to test the border, to cross the edge. What and why were never questions for me. How was the only question. When I look back now, I realize that I never thought about what I wanted to become in life. I only thought about how I wanted to live my life. And I knew that the how could only be determined within me and by me. There was a great boom in poultry farming at the time. I wanted to make some money to finance my desire for unrestrained, purposeless travel. So I got into it. My father said, "What am I going to tell people? That my son is rearing chickens?" But I built my poultry farm, and I built it single-handedly from scratch. The business took off, profits started rolling in. I devoted my 4 hours every morning to the business. The rest of the day was spent reading and writing poetry, swimming in the well, meditating, daydreaming on a huge banyan tree. Success made me adventurous. My father was always lamenting that everyone else's sons had become engineers, industrialists, joined the civil service or gone to America. And everywhere, everyone I met, my friends, relatives, my old school and college teachers, said, "Oh, we thought you did make something of your life, but you are just wasting it." I took on the challenge. In partnership with a civil engineer friend, I entered the construction business. In 5 years, we became a major construction company among the leading private contractors in Mysore. My father was incredulous and delighted. I was exuberant and sure-footed, adrenaline charged, and itching for a challenge. When everything you do is a success, you tend to start believing that the planets revolve around you, not the sun. And that was the kind of young man I was that fateful afternoon of September 1982 when I decided to get on my Czech motorcycle and ride up Chamundi Hill. I had no clue then that my life would never be the same again. Later, when I tried to talk to my friends about what had happened that day upon the mountain, all they could ask was, "Did you drink something? Did you pop something?" They were even more clueless than I was of this new dimension that had suddenly exploded into my life. Even before I had begun to process what it meant, the experience returned. It was a week later. I was sitting at the dining table with my family. I thought it lasted 2 minutes, but it was 7 hours. I was sitting right there, fully aware, except that the me I knew as myself was not there anymore. Everything else was, and the time flipped. I remember various members of my family tapping me on the shoulder, asking me what happened, urging me to eat my meal. I simply raised my hand and asked them to leave. They were accustomed to my strange ways by then. They left me alone. It was almost 4:15 in the morning when I returned to my normal senses. The experience began to happen more frequently. When it occurred, I neither ate nor slept for hours on end. I simply sat rooted to a single spot. On one occasion, the experience lasted for up to 13 days. I happened to be in a village when it began. This state of overwhelming and indescribable stillness and ecstasy. The villagers gathered around me and started whispering to each other, "Oh, he must be in Samadhi, a blissful state of being beyond the body, well documented in the Indian spiritual traditions." India, being the country it is, there was a traditional understanding of spirituality to which they were a heir that I, with my blue denim-wrapped brain, had no clue about. When I emerged from that state, someone wanted to put a garland around me, another wanted to touch my feet. It was crazy. I could not believe anyone would want to do this to me.